with many stories that all contribute to a wonderful, amazing, cosmic, global victory of God over evil. And the earth, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth, and so about the rest of the Bible, we're going to be talking primarily about the earth. That was quick. The heavens and the earth. Okay, the earth. The earth was without form and void. And those two Hebrew words rhyme. It's interesting. Tohu vabohu. And God did it on purpose to reveal things about him. He, on the first day, made the earth formless and empty so that he would show his forming nature and his filling nature. And I honestly, just if you're smart, you remember stuff. I struggled to remember the 6 days of creation through my master's degree. And then I saw the outline. I'm like, well, that's easy. I could remember this. Days 1 through 3, God forms. And days 4 through 6, God fills. Days 1 through 3, he makes habitats. And on days 4 through 6, he makes inhabitants. So what he's doing is he's making a place for a people. And that phrase is huge. A place for a people. A light out of darkness, space, waters above, waters below, atmosphere, condensed water, separated dry land from vegetation, earth. And then when we go through, we're no longer without form, and we're no longer void. And so, like on day 1, he made light, on day 4, he made lights. And those lights are to rule the sphere, the habitat of space, day and night. The waters above, the atmosphere, and the waters below are filled with birds and fish, and the land is filled with land animals. Make sense? God makes a place, God prepares a place for his inhabitants. He makes habitats. And the pattern's full. We're good. But God's not done. On the sixth day, God continues. He adds one other thing. And like ancient kings would do in a conquered vassal state, he sets up his image. A king would come in and spare your life, maybe, if you would agree to the terms of servitude and to the sheep or the goats or whatever tax he would calculate he could get out of you. But he would set his image in the conquered land to remind everybody who is the true ruler. And God on this earth set his image in man. Let us make man after our image and let him rule. So God is ruling. God is the ruler. And yet God has given man the privilege of ruling in his place and on his behalf. And this isn't Eden. This is Oaxaca. This is Mexico. Eden wasn't a beach, but I'm trying to go for paradise. Okay, I'm trying to go for paradise. Especially if you're from Elko, all that water, right? All that water. God is king. He rules. God has a people. He's got a place for that people. How does God rule? He rules through his word, Genesis 1, and God said, and God said, and God said 10 times. And what is his word like? In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, after having said multiple times, and God said, and God said, Genesis 1:28 says, and God blessed them and said. So God's word is good. Everything he had done was good. But in giving man the kingdom mandate, the rule over creation, God was good in giving man family. I have a friend who got a job in Mexico at a call center, which supports a German company whose employees are in the U.S. And they said, good, you start Monday. Monday's a holiday in America, don't come. We start paying you. Brother Jesus goes to Round Mountain tomorrow to start a new job. Imagine, no, tomorrow's a holiday. Don't come tomorrow, come Tuesday, but we start paying you tomorrow. Right? Okay, sixth day, you're going to get married right now. Tomorrow's a holiday. You start work the next day. Like, is God evil and bad to give man just a wife and a family and a job and a holiday to start his career? God rules through his word. His word is blessing. His word is rest. God, Genesis 2:15, God placed. The Hebrew verb is he rested. He rested man. And that man is a king. He's in charge of everything. He's a priest. He communes directly with God. Eden is a sanctuary. It's a mountaintop sanctuary. The world is perfect, but nature is one thing. A garden is something different. And so God says to man, subdue nature and turn perfect nature into a garden. Take the garden global. I formed and I filled. You are to form and fill the world. So when you clean your house, when you bake cookies, when you have your flowers, when you weld, you are echoing the divine forming. And when you promote community and life, and you're filling. We enjoy forming and filling because we are made in God's image. And I'm going to call that the project. You could say it in these words. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Father, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. What does that mean? That God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Man was commissioned by God to set up the kingdom. But by chapter 3, sin enters. And Satan comes in some form of a serpent. And man falls. Man rejects God's word. Man rejects God's rule. Man rejects God. And so the paradise that God has given to man is lost. And that place that God has put him, God made a place for a people. The people don't want God, and they lose their place. And man is destitute. He is kicked out, and he's cursed. And that curse brings on man not just the loss of the sanctuary, the divine presence. Man was in God's presence, and he communed with God, and he walked with God, and he talked with God. And now the sanctuary and the presence is lost, and that failure brings God's judgment. But when God judges, God promises salvation. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. And in Genesis chapter 3, you have, when God judges, he promises salvation. And so, in this amazing statement, the hero of our story is announced. There's foreshadowing of the great coming champion, and his title is the woman's seed. Now, you picture that in the ancient world. Your warrior hero, your rescue hero is the woman's seed. And that's unexpected, and that's almost, in the ancient world, insulting. But what we hear is that God is going to do his rescue plan via the unexpected way, and he's going to use smallness and littleness, and he's going to use sterility, and he's going to use infertility, and he's going to use virginity, and he's going to use littleness to do his great rescue work. Now, Adam himself failed. And his sons go out and they do no better. Cain kills his brother. God raises up a substitute, Seth. And God judges Adam's sons. Seth and his family don't establish God's kingdom. By the time Noah comes onto the scene, the family of Seth is mixed with the family of Cain, and God judges. But Noah is a resetting of creation. And in chapter 9 of Genesis, it sounds like we haven't gotten anywhere from chapter 1, verse 28. He blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Genesis chapter 9, verse 1 says, and God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The project hasn't changed. But where Adam and his sons failed, God raises up a second Adam, a second father of all mankind, a second one who has rule over nature. And so Noah is God's means to preserve creation. Noah's name means rest. And his father, when Noah was born, Lamech said, man, I wish God would give us rest from our sin-cursed world. And in a sense, he does, because all the sinners are eliminated, except for the eight that were on the ark. Because Noah, whose job it is to bless and to establish God's kingdom, by the time he's drunk and passed out, wakes up, he ends up cursing his own grandson. And so the rest that Lamech longed for did not come with his son Noah. Noah receives the same commission. And by chapter 10, we see his personal failure. By chapter 11, we see his sons and the Tower of Babel. Adam and his sons failed to establish God's kingdom. Noah and his sons failed to establish God's kingdom, and God judges. But God provides a promise of salvation. And in Babel, the nations are formed. So the question is, where will God's salvation to the nations, formed in judgment, come as the story unfolds? And the answer is, chapter 12 of Genesis through the end of the Bible, God will choose Abraham and make of him a nation whose job it is to bless the nations and to do God's work. He will give them more revelation. He will give them a land. He will give them a sanctuary. He will give them all these elements: rule, sea, land, word, blessing, rest. He'll do it all through this nation. Of course, Abraham's wife is sterile, and his daughter-in-law is sterile, and his granddaughter-in-law, that's a good English word I just made up, is also sterile, right? You have three sterile matriarchs. That's how God does it. And so God gives Abraham promises of these things that I've mentioned that are key elements to the story. But this is the nation to bless the nations. And so does Abraham do it? Well, personally, like Adam, like Noah, Abraham had his failures. Genesis 16, he has a son with Hagar. He banishes his own son eventually, and Abraham, in spite of being the father of the faith, all these heroes that we're seeing here do amazing things in terms of faith, obedience, and victory, but yet at the end of the day, the summary of their story is they did not establish God's kingdom. God makes promises. Abraham, in your seed will come the rulers. In fact, in Genesis 28, when Isaac blesses Jacob, he says, go and may God make you fruitful and multiply and may you fill the earth. Okay, so Jacob is the one now who will be God's agent. And Joseph rules. But amazingly, the promise of the scepter is given to Judah. But here's the nation that will bless the nations. And we look through the lives of the patriarchs, and Abraham had his failures. Isaac was pretty carnal. Jacob was a scoundrel and a scam and a thief and a cheater. Joseph was a great guy. Judah was a mess. And yet, God judges and saves. And he gives them a commission. And God raises up Moses. We're into the book of Exodus already. Moses, commissioned to take Israel to Canaan. Moses, I am God, but I will give you and the nation rulership. You will be the head over all the nations, a special people for me. You are my people. I will give you a land. I will give you a sanctuary. In fact, I will give you my presence, the tabernacle. I will give you more words, and I will bless you if your obedient faith, if your faith produces obedience. If your incredulity produces disobedience, then my curse will come upon you, because I will bless obedient faith, and I will judge sin. Moses comes back and delivers the people, but he himself does not enter Canaan. Nor does he put God's people into the rest. Moses doesn't deliver the goods. And these are the heroes. These are the guys who did stuff that we would never even aspire to do. And so Joshua takes the people into the promised land. During the Mosaic epic, something begins in Israel on a formal level. You have Abraham, who lived 2,000 years before Christ. You have Moses, who lived 1,500 years before Christ. You have David, who lived 1,000 years before Christ. And then during the exile return, it's 500 years before Christ. So if you can think round numbers, 500 years. 2,000 is Abraham, 1,500 is Moses. And Moses institutes something for Israel to preserve their spiritual life and help them walk with God. Priests, religion, sacrifices, law, and there's a very complex and detailed system of law to show man the pervasive nature of sin and the necessity of a sacrifice who would wash away the sin and restore man's presence to God. Now, the first high priest of the whole nation is Moses' older brother, who a couple chapters before he gets ordained and starts ministering makes a golden calf and leads the entire nation in idolatry. And when his four sons are ordained with him in Leviticus 10, two of them go against the prescribed offering, and two of them died basically during the ordination service. And our priestly system is not off to a very good start. And these are the guys at the beginning. Things tend to go downhill. And what we learn after the book of Joshua is that the priests did not maintain the spiritual life of Israel. In fact, this is sobering. You have the story of the judges who spiraled down over 400 years. But then we hear in the book of Judges two stories, the tribe of Dan and the tribe of Benjamin. Oh, yeah, and the tribe of Dan. You know, Moses' grandson led the tribe of Dan in idolatry, you know? Like, what? Yeah, Moses' grandson led an entire tribe in idolatry. Like, what? The priests were not able to maintain the spiritual life. And the proof of that is God raised up judges to deliver them because God gave his word and God gave his blessing on obedient faith, and disobedient faith resulted in judgment and death for his own people. And so when the priests failed and the judges failed, God raised up not a big tall guy like Saul, not a big tall guy like Eliab, a humble, the eighth son, like, he didn't even get invited to the contest. We're going to anoint a king. And Jesse? You know, he invites, I got seven boys. You know, if these seven don't work, I mean, I got the guy out. That's the guy God chooses. And God uses the small so that the power and the excellence of the glory may be of him. And how did David do? Well, except for the time when he fornicated, you know, with the neighbor lady. And except for the time where he took the census of the people and was proud about his stuff. David doesn't establish the kingdom. David's very concerned about worship and temple. And God says, you're a blood-shedding man, and my temple's not going to be built by a blood-shedding man. And so, in a sense, David fails. His son does something we haven't seen since Moses. Moses built a tabernacle, and the glory came down. The presence of God was with his people. In the days of Samuel, the presence of God had obviously abandoned his people. The son of David restores God's presence on earth. He restores the rule. He promotes the seed. It makes the land more stable than it's ever been. There's more word that's given, and there's more blessing, and there's more rest like we've never had it. When the son of David reigned, we were at the high point of the Old Testament, and it lasts for one chapter. Because by the next chapter, Solomon has gone after foreign women. And when you read the book of Kings, what you find is the kings didn't do any better than the judges. God anointed the priests to promote their spiritual life, and they failed, and God raised up judges. God anointed kings. We've had two groups anointed, priests and kings. Those are messianic. Those are anointed. Those are God's special agents to preserve the spiritual life and to promote. And so when the priests failed and the kings failed, who did God raise up? The prophets. And 1 and 2 Kings is a contest between the rebellious kings and the God-sent prophets. And the prophets never failed. Their word always succeeded. But did the prophets keep Israel from being exiled like Adam was exiled? So in one sense, the prophets never failed. But in the sense of global expansion of the kingdom, and we're going to set up God's kingdom, and the world will be brought to peace and unity. We're going to fix it under God's word. In that sense, the prophets also failed, and the whole story of the Old Testament is a big cycle. It's a big wheel that goes around and around, and it's got five basic elements. You've got, it begins with the creation, you've got Adam. And then God gives, in creation, God gives man a commission. When man rebels and disobeys, he fails, it brings judgment on him, but with judgment is always the promise of hope and of salvation, and then God makes a new creation. And all of that, the story of the Bible, has as the center, the axis around which this cycle revolves, is that God is glorified in creating. God is glorified in commissioning and blessing. When man fails, God's justice is seen. He is just, but he's also, his goodness is seen simultaneously in the giving of a promise and not giving up on his project. A new creation, it begins. And so if you want kind of the advanced version, what you have is the initial creation, commission, failure, judgment, and promise. And that promise now loops us back around, and we're ready to start again. And we're going to start with a second commission and a second creation, and sadly man repeatedly fails. And so there's your new creation, the beginning of a new cycle, and then you've got your new commission. Noah fails, judgment. the project goes forward, and yet we've got more holes, and we're getting more rust, and it's not going well. Things are advancing, and yet at the same time, they're deteriorating. And so the cycle begins to repeat and repeat and repeat. And where do we see this cycle? Well, we see it as we saw it in the beginning there with Adam and his descendants. We saw it with Noah. We saw it with Abraham. With Moses, he himself clarifies that his covenant, his promise with God, is of a different nature than the other ones. But behind him or after him, we have the Davidic covenant. And so by the time you get to the end of the Old Testament, what you're looking for to fix this endless cycle of failure is somebody who can come and take all the Adamic promises and commission and say, oh, and while I'm at it, I'll take all the Noahic promises and commission, and I'll take all the law's promises and commission, and the Abrahamic, and I'll take the Davidic. I'll just take the whole Old Testament, the law and the prophets. I'll take the whole Old Testament, and I'll put a big check mark right there. No individual could do it himself at the time, but I'll just take it all, and I'll make the whole project work. That's the story of the Bible. That's the story of God bringing glory to himself by establishing his kingdom. So the Old Testament leaves us with that question: who will stop this unending cycle? And the answer that Moses gives us, the answer that Joshua, the answer that all of them give us, is that future coming champion will bring the blessing. He will remove the sin. He will remove the judgment, and he will set up rest and peace and blessing and extend God's kingdom globally. You know, when Jesus did it, he did it as your ideal Psalm 1 person. He did it as your ideal child. Love for the Father and a love for the Word. And when you talk about obedience, how about obedience unto death? Okay, how about obedience unto the death on a cross? How about 40 days of suffering, fasting, weeping in the wilderness? And God is showing that in spite of man's repeated failure, his love is persistent. And anyone who puts his faith in that Redeemer gets absorbed into the success and the perfection and the victory that that champion achieved in your place and on your behalf. And you show up, and in him, all that he accomplished is yours by grace. And he did it all, and he just invites you to share in his victory. And that's the story of the Bible. That God is bringing glory to himself by stepping into suffering, stepping into tears, stepping into deprivation, stepping into death, and suffering the eternal rejection that man deserves on the cross in the person of his Son. And that victory brings true and genuine forgiveness. You're clean. You're actually and permanently clean. And in the Old Testament, if you had a skin issue, you couldn't be in the tabernacle. In fact, with some skin issues, you couldn't even be in the congregation. And then those who were whole in body and qualified would still have to purify themselves. There were rites and there were rituals, and even the most holy and solemn rituals, the yearly atonement where the high priest would bathe himself 5 times on one day and change his clothes and go in and offer sacrifices for himself and then for the people, all of that left you with a certain sense of achievement, but also it taught you, and we'll be back next year because this doesn't definitively cover it. But in Jesus, you have absolute and perfect forgiveness. You have absolute and constant, perfect peace with God. And it's a power that transforms you. The grace of God enables and gives. And you could have the carrot or the stick. The donkey doesn't move. We've got the stick and we've got the carrot. But grace is just as crushing as the stick. when you understand the level of your perversity, when you understand the level of your depravity, when you understand the level of your rejection of God, even as a believer, even as a Christian, when you really strive for holiness and righteousness and you really want to love God and love your fellow man, you begin to understand how bad you really are. And it's crushing. But then there's Jesus, whose person and work, his death on the cross, his showing God's love to you, when you come to value him supremely, grace flows and fills. And ironically, the more broken the vessel, the more useful it is, because then grace flows from all the cracks and all the holes. And God is pouring himself out in you and through you. And like Israel was to bless the nations, and like Noah was to bring rest, God gives you a rest so that you can be his agent to give rest. God gives you blessing so that you can be an agent to bring blessing. God transforms you so that you might be his agent of transformation. And in the church, we are new creations and we have a new commission. But it's the same. It's thy kingdom come, thy will be done. It's fill the earth with worshipers. And so Jesus redeems. Jesus stepped in to a fallen world. Our hero came voluntarily, lovingly. And he doesn't just patch and weld and paint over and a little bit of Bondo and you're on your way. It's vital. It's life. There's new life. There's new power. And as you grow in your understanding, when you turn to him by faith, saying, Lord, I recognize that I'm proud and full of desires that don't honor you. I recognize I'm a sinner. I don't want to submit to your rule. But you offer me forgiveness because Jesus took on the cross my condemnation, and in him I can be forgiven. When you surrender to the King, he begins to restore his image. And when you talk to people, when you work, when things happen, you react, but that wasn't you. That was Jesus' thoughts. Those were Jesus' words. You're a new person. You don't think like you used to think. You don't act like you used to act. You don't talk like the divine image. You look like Jesus. You sound like Jesus. You're transformed. And by the end, Romans 9:29 says that you will be like the firstborn. And on a cosmic, global scale, there's a new creation. I believe there's a millennium during which Jesus will reign, and God's word and God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven for 1,000 years, and that's going to be one of your jobs. You're going to be making sure that God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. God's Son does it. But then there's the Noah. Then there's the, what if we wipe the whole thing clean and we had an eternal creation as the initial creation was meant to be? And that's what Jesus achieves. He redeems and restores. And he does it so that God may be glorified. And I just invite you to contemplate whether you're okay with that. Whether you're okay with the glory of God being the final thing and the final answer. Because honestly, as a sinner, I find that my sympathy is with man. I find myself sometimes objecting to what I know the Bible reveals. And I conclude that my problem must be that I fail to value God for whom he is. If I knew God, if I could understand his worth, his wisdom, his greatness, his love, I would be in agreement with it. But that's the story of the Bible. God glorifies himself by taking the curse, by taking the exile, by taking the punishment. And he redeems man. He restores man's rule. He redeems a people. He restores Eden. He gave Israel a tabernacle. He gave Israel a temple. He gives the church a spiritual temple. But at the end, all creation is our place. And he eternally rules. And the transformation that he does, you eternally want to do right and are able. You eternally want to glorify God, and you do. And it's the only thing you do. And every redeemed inhabitant of the new creation loves God and loves his fellow man perfectly. And how did God do that? By means of his Son. The story of the Bible is God glorifies himself, redeeming all things and restoring his image in man. We ended early. I can take questions. I can't necessarily answer them, but I can take them. What wonderful love he had. Has. God commended. God showed. God demonstrated his love to us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. For a good man, one would peradventure die. But he came for rabble.